So this is an almost impossible talk to give, I want to start out by saying, because I want to try to explain to you some of the impact that string theory has had in mathematics, but that would mean, if I were really to do that, that I would need to explain the mathematics that it had an impact on, and that would take me at least a semester for my graduate students, perhaps. Much less people who haven't had much mathematical training. Moreover, there's an interesting philosophy among a number of physicists, which is that the mathematics that goes into physics ought to be quote-unquote elementary. The only way I can interpret this philosophy is that elementary means the stuff I learned in graduate school, as opposed to anything that undergraduate, as opposed to anything else that might have come along later. But of course, we might consider differential geometry sufficiently elementary these days that we could study relativity, but that wouldn't have been true 100 years ago if the undergraduate or graduate school is the criterion. Similarly, we can't do anything with quantum mechanics without learning about Hilbert spaces and various mathematical tools, which were actually only developed in reaction to the formulations of quantum mechanics that were going on in the 20s. So I think people have to be willing to broaden their horizons. Nevertheless, I'm confronted with an audience that didn't spend their formative years learning about such things as K3 surfaces like I did. So I'm going to have to try to spend a lot of my time giving you some kind of background or some kind of flavor for some of the subjects that string theory has had an impact on. Now, why is it that we have such a close relationship between string theory and certain branches of mathematics? Well, it's because string theories, these string models of the universe, the ones that are actively studied, are 10 or 11 dimensional. Well, we need some new terminology, but I'll stick with the term string model to encompass things like M-theory. They're 10 or 11 dimensional at the outset, but we believe that if these string models are formulated and studied on spacetimes of the form, well, some kind of compact space and then some Minkowski space of different dimensions, so a product manifold where some of the 10 dimensions are wrapped around a compact direction, then there's some kind of effective theory in Minkowski space which describes our world. And the details of this effective theory, things like scattering amplitudes or coupling constants, the things which we should actually hope one day to go out and measure in a laboratory to compare with the predictions that are being made, these details are encoded in the structure of X. So whatever kind of structure X has, this compact part of the space X has, that is going to lead to these physically measurable quantities in these theories, various things like scattering amplitudes and coupling constants in the effective theory, those we should expect to have a very close connection to the physics and to the overall setup. So that's the basic reason that study of these compact spaces with not just arbitrary compact spaces, but ones which are well adapted for this process of compactifying string models down to a lower dimensional space-time, they have a very, there's a very close connection between the geometric structures of these things and the study of the physics of, say, four-dimensional or, as I'll probably focus more on today, six- or seven-dimensional effective theories when you're compactifying string theory. Well, although the goal may be eventually to understand the theories with the correct amount of supersymmetry in the dimension that we actually live in. As a kind of warm-up exercise, we've spent a lot of time studying theories in higher dimensions, higher effective dimensions, and with larger amounts of supersymmetry than the world that we actually live in. And there are a number of reasons for that, but anyway, that's where the mathematical surprises that I want to discuss have become most concrete to date. So, just as an example of how this works, one of the string models, the one that is often believed to give the, or I should say in pre-duality days, was often claimed to give the nicest phenomenological results. I mean, these days we understand that many of these models are different aspects of some underlying bigger picture that would incorporate all of them. But anyway, the heterotic string with gauge group E8 cross E8, it's one of the string models. It's usually studied in 10 dimensions. And at low energies, it looks pretty much like this supergravity theory, so some kind of gravity coupled to Yang-Mills with the specified gauge group. And if I formulate it now on a space, well, if I take X to be a D torus, so I'll for illustrative purposes, I'll you're welcome to use this as an aisle if you need to. Yes. So for just to get started, I'll stick with a flat space, but one which has been wrapped up along a torus. So a TD stands for a D torus, and what that means is that I make periodic identifications, in the first D direction. So I take X1 to XD, and I'll identify those. X1 is the same as X1 plus R1. I'll choose different radii. And actually, you could do things a little bit more generally than what I'm saying now. You can allow some kind of shearing as well in making your identification. So it's slightly misleading, but not too misleading to think of it as just identifications at different radii. That compactifies some of the dimensions, leaving me with the remaining dimensions and some kind of effective theory. And what is it that's going to label things like scattering amplitudes and coupling constants in that theory? Well, I need to know a little bit about the field content. I kind of said it here. It's gravity coupled to Yang-Mills. So there's going to be some Riemannian metric, which captures the information about the gravity. And there are going to be these Yang-Mills gauge fields. They're also going to be, so this is called the Kaluza-Klein reduction method. And when you reduce the 10-dimensional gravity field, you get a metric on the compact space. You get these, sorry, didn't do this in the best possible order. I get a Riemannian metric. I get some Kaluza-Klein gauge fields. It's another remnant of the 10-dimensional metric from the 10-dimensional space, and I get these Yang-Mills gauge fields. And, sorry, the Yang-Mills part gives me Yang-Mills gauge fields in lower dimension, but it also gives me some kind of Yang-Mills fields in the compact direction. And the thing which I really need to label this theory, to label the possible, I should have said, this is going to be a theory, this compactified theory, the effective one, with a large vacuum degeneracy. And what I'm attempting to do is specify what the possible vacua are. So this choice of Riemannian metric on the D torus, the choice of a Yang-Mills field satisfying the equations of motion, Yang-Mills equations of motion, also on the D torus, together with the coupling constant from the heterotic string, there's a single coupling in the heterotic string, those items together, things I've underlined here, those items together will label the possible vacua in this theory. And there's a name for the space that you get as a result. I'll separate out, as is common, the coupling constant for the heterotic string, and then I'll just call this N sub D for Narine. For those people who like fancier-looking names, it's a space which mathematically gets described this way as OD comma 16 plus D mod OD cross O 16 plus D mod some integer version of the same group. But anyway, that name isn't so relevant for my purposes today. The point is that by doing what in this case amounts to a fairly simple analysis of dimensional reduction or compactification on this torus, seeing what sort of things would survive at low energy by looking for things which solve the equations of motion, you end up discovering how to describe all the possible vacua in this case. Well, doing things on a torus here, I said that the heterotic string with gauge group E8 cross E8 was phenomenologically favorable. That's if you use a more complicated space than a torus. If you just use a torus, the amount of supersymmetry in the resulting theory is not is larger than you actually want for phenomenological purposes. Okay, so this is sort of the foot in the door for why there will be a relationship between certain geometric areas of mathematics and string theory as we're studying it in the 90s. Well, the question arises, why isn't the mathematics we need in order to carry out this procedure of taking one of the string theories that we know about, compactifying on some nice compact space, and calculating the resulting effective theory, why isn't the mathematics we need available to us? When you think back over history, sometimes the mathematics has already been available. The theory of general relativity is a good example of that. It took quite a while for Einstein to hit upon the correct mathematical formulation and to learn that there were these tools available and how and to imagine how they might be employed. But he didn't actually have to make any major breakthroughs in Riemannian geometry in order to formulate his theory of gravity. On the other hand, I'm not an expert in the history of the state of continuous mathematics at the time of Newton, but Newton had to make, at the very least, major reformulations in continuous mathematics. And really, I mean, he and Leibniz are both credited with inventing the calculus for this purpose. Well, let me not give a historical lecture on the development of the calculus, but there are interesting developments before that which he drew upon in important ways. But it really was true, I think, it's fair to say, that the mathematics that Newton needed was not completely available. So one can ask, in this particular case, why isn't the mathematics available? And I have a couple of possible answers for that. The first is that the problems, the mathematical problems, are very hard ones. So when I'm working with something like a flat space, then I was able to give a description, for example, of all the Riemannian metrics on the flat space without too much difficulty. And the reason I was able to give that description so easily is that the metrics that I needed, it wasn't arbitrary Riemannian metrics, but the metrics that I needed happened to be invariant under the natural translations on this torus. So there's a large symmetry group here, and a large symmetry group is going to give you, at the very least, a tool for studying and hopefully solving mathematical problems. In the more complicated cases that lead to more realistic physical models in lower effective dimensions, we don't have large symmetry groups like that. We don't have tricks of that sort available to us. And just as a kind of sample of the difficulty of the problems, let me mention a little result of Jean Colombi from the late 50s. So Colombi showed that if you're interested in So if you're interested in what are called Ricci flat metrics on X, so I need to sort of ease my way towards discussing the specific types of curved spaces that will be relevant to this string compactification process. And the first thing that you learn from the equations of motion, which are Einstein's equations, if you want to produce an effective theory in flat space, is that although the last month that's not what people have been doing, is that you should take as your compact space something which satisfies an interesting little equation, something called the Ricci tensor should vanish. So I want the Ricci, certain quantity extracted from the curvature of the compact manifold should vanish. So suppose you've got a metric. So if you're given two, these are called Ricci flat metrics, say Gij and Gij prime on the same x, and there's supposed to be another little technical condition on these metrics. They're called Kähler, and that's a consequence, for my purposes, of the supersymmetry, which is in the background of all of these discussions, but which I'm not really going to be mentioning explicitly. Well, being Kähler means that there is an associated Kähler class, which is usually called omega. And Colombi studied the situation that would arise if you had two different Ricci flat metrics which had the same Kähler class omega. So if that's true, if that's true, then Gij has to be equal to Gij prime. So, and I want to mention, just because people will be familiar with this kind of technique in one form or another, the proof involves the fact that harmonic functions on a compact space are constant. So when you try to solve the Laplace equation on a harmonic space, the solutions are constants. So that's some kind of information about Ricci flat metrics, which have this extra property that's known as Kähler. It says that there's some fairly simple mathematical construction that you can make to associate some kind of invariant to that metric. And that invariant really captures the identity of the metric. This is a uniqueness theorem. It says that if you've got two metrics, if you thought you had two metrics, but you noticed that this invariant agreed for the two metrics, then you actually, turns out, have the same metric instead of having two different metrics. So it suggested a natural problem, which came to be known as the Colombi conjecture, which is that given an appropriate omega, there exists a Gij. So the Colombi conjecture tells you, the Colombi result tells you about uniqueness, and the Colombi conjecture suggests that these Ricci flat metrics exist Gij such that the Ricci curvature of Gij is equal to zero, I should say, in that class. And this was solved by S.T. Yao in the late 70s. And led directly to the awarding of his Fields Medal. Well, that and a few other big problems that he solved, but this was one of the big ones. And I just wanted to tell that story partly to indicate the indirectness of our current state of knowledge of these Ricci flat metrics. So basically, we know how to find the omegas. We don't know how to find very explicitly the GIJs. This is a very abstract proof. And it's an extremely difficult result. So one of the reasons that the mathematics needed for this study is not immediately available is that the mathematical problems involved are quite difficult. One can hope, in fact, maybe not for this particular problem, but one can hope to get some kind of insight into some of these problems by relating them to things in string theory, which perhaps in some dual formulation are going to turn out to be easier than the original mathematical problem that gave rise to them. Although this can be a two-way street in some situations as well. So that's one of the reasons that the mathematics isn't available. The second reason is that quantum effects, or doing this in a quantum context, may lead to mathematical problems not previously studied. So I think it's fair to say that the connection to string theory got started some 12 or 14 years ago, the only aspects of these mathematical objects that have been studied were their kind of classical geometric aspects, things that are directly related to this equation that the Ricci curvature vanishes, which is the classical equation of motion. And if there are modifications in some quantum theory that's going to contain gravity as one of its aspects, which is the sort of thing that we're producing from string theory, those are not going to have been incorporated in the mathematical problems that were traditionally studied. And the third reason that the mathematics isn't available to us is related to what I'll talk about for the rest of the talk, which is that duality has shown that there are surprising relations among different mathematical aspects of these objects. And it really suggests that when the full story is known in some decades from now, it's going to look quite a bit different from the traditional way that these things have been approached. But somehow incorporating the lessons that we're learning from duality together with some modifications from quantum effects and this interplay between mathematics and physics is likely, in my view, to lead to some rather different way of looking at the entire mathematical question of what are these Calabi-Yau manifolds. That's what they were named after, the solution by Yau to the Calabi conjecture. What are these Calabi-Yau manifolds, and how do we ask and answer mathematical questions about them? I think those things may well look extremely different sometime down the road, once we've understood this better.
Dave, can you say another word about omega? Is it some kind of pointing number?
Omega is a class in the second Durand cohomology of X, and it's basically another quantity that's extracted from the curvature tensor and producing a two-form, some anti-symmetric tensor on the space. And the fact that I made it in Durand cohomology means that I have to do something, means, just to put it a little bit more concretely, there's this explicit expression in the curvature that I would be making from GIJ and from GIJ prime, and then The actual equation says that there's going to be some function f such that omega minus omega prime, that, this is what it means for them to have to define the same class, is dd bar log f. And that's the form, in fact, in which Yao managed to solve the problem, the existence of such an f. So what Yao did was he started with a metric that wasn't Ricci flat, and he produced a metric that was Ricci flat in the same class. So he actually produced the function f, which made that kind of change. And he did it by some kind of method of successive approximations, and showing that this successive approximations converge is an extremely difficult thing and doesn't give you any notion of what the converged solution looks like. Well, I want to spend some time discussing the simplest kinds of curved manifolds that can appear in any of these stories. And these are things that are called K3 surfaces. So already, the Kolobi conjecture and Yao's result would have applied to a discussion of Ricci flat metrics on a torus, but Ricci flat metrics on a torus are flat, and the flat metrics are easy, very easy to describe concretely. But K3 surfaces, which are actually four manifolds, four-dimensional manifolds, they're called surfaces because they're two complex dimensional manifolds. So they have a natural structure of a complex manifold, something that has two local complex coordinates, but that turns into four real coordinates, which is why there's this funny ambiguity in the terminology. And these were also, the study of these things also dates from the 1950s, when people started studying certain kinds of geometric structures in detail for the first time. So these kind of arose in the study of these complex manifolds. And one of the first places I know where these K3 surfaces came to light was in the following kind of problem. So suppose you write down a simple polynomial equation in many variables, but a single equation. So you might typically write something like z1 to the 4 plus z2 to the 4 plus z3 to the 4 is equal to 1 as some kind of example. Now, the natural context for studying solutions to polynomial equations is, first of all, you should take the solutions to be complex. Well, let's see. That was a pretty mathematician-sounding phrase. all the real solutions will also be complex solutions. So we certainly won't lose any solutions if we treat the variables as complex numbers. But even better, there's the phenomenon illustrated by the fundamental theorem of algebra, which is something we know about for polynomials in one variable, which says that any polynomial in one variable has a root over the complex numbers. So we can expect that the structure of the solution set will simplify tremendously if we allow the variables to be complex, and then one can sort of break the problem into two parts if one wanted to know about real solutions and study the real, try to figure out which of the complex solutions are real afterwards. Okay, so when you have a polynomial, a single polynomial in many variables, it's natural to take the variables to be complex, and you should also put the solution set into projective space. Let's call projective space. And the reason for that is to control, to gain some kind of control over this structure of the space as you head out towards infinity in the usual variables. So if you know about projective space, that's great. If you don't know about projective space, just take my word that it's a way of adding on information about asymptotic behavior of the original solution set. So the solution set is itself a complex manifold. So manifold just means something which can be described by some local coordinate. Here I've got a single equation in a bunch of variables, and it'll be a manifold if the polynomial is generic. So unless I make an accident and create some kind of singularity by my choice of coefficients in the equation, I'll actually be able at any given point to eliminate one of the variables in favor of the others using this equation and treat the other ones as free parameters locally. So that makes it into a complex manifold. And you can ask a sort of abstract question, what happens if you deform the structure of the complex manifold? Well, one way to do that deformation is that you could vary the coefficients. Or more generally, it might be that there are certain other terms that you can add to this polynomial equation which don't change the essential character of the solution set. So it could vary the coefficients, including some that are zero, currently zero, and produce other complex manifolds in that way. And it was discovered by Kadaira and Spencer in the late 50s that once you get beyond two variables, so once you get to a complex two-dimensional manifold or beyond, that's the only way that you can deform the structure of a complex manifold. So that's the only way, if number of variables is bigger than two, unless you have a K3 surface. In fact, the exception is a quartic equation in three variables, the one that I wrote here. So when you're studying polynomial equations in many variables, this particular case of a quartic equation in three variables turns out to be very exceptional. And these are the things known as K3 surfaces. So one approach to K3 surfaces is to study quartic equations in three variables. When I mentioned the Kolobi conjecture, I forgot the main hypothesis. So the main hypothesis was supposed to be if there exists a non-vanishing holomorphic D-form on X, so D is the complex dimension of X. Then the statement that I made is what's supposed to hold. So that is actually true in this case. There is a non-vanishing holomorphic 2 form on this K3. So to write it in a kind of efficient way here, I can take a form with a pole all along the K3, and then I can take the residue of that form with a pole. So this is like the residues that occur in one complex variable where you get something on the polar locus as a result of taking a residue. If that's a little unfamiliar, then another way of describing the same thing is to take dz1 with dz2 divided by the partial with respect to the third variable of the equation. And that ends up, when you chase it through complex numbers and projective space, producing a holomorphic, a non-vanishing holomorphic 2 form on this particular surface. So it's something to which the Calabi conjecture applies. So we know there exist Ricci flat metrics. And in fact, we know how to describe the set of all Ricci flat metrics. We need to describe the complex structures which, well, this observation of Kadara and Spencer that this particular class of quartics had this special property that the deformations of complex structure was a little bit bigger than just varying the polynomials, that was studied much further over the ensuing 20 or 30 years until a complete theory of what all the deformations of complex structures were was arrived at. You also have to study these classes omega, the allowed classes omega. And it actually turns out that in this particular case, there's a little bit of overcounting here. So you have to mod out by some kind of identification. And you produce a space which describes all the possible Ricci flat metrics. And it turns out that this space, well, it's got an R plus in it, which is measuring the volume of the K3, the volume of the metric on the K3. And then it has a complicated structure, which turns out to be the space that a few minutes ago was called M sub 3, the Narayan 3 space. So that was a space, O319 mod O3 cross O19 mod some other guy on the other side. So and I should say minus a few points. There are a few points from this space which don't actually describe Ricci flat metrics, and I'll say a word or two about that in a minute. So this was a kind of hard-fought result. It's a little easier to prove these days than it used to be, but it relies on all sorts of indirect things, such as this Yao's proof of the Calabi conjecture. Proving that this is exactly the set of Ricci flat metrics again, it falls in that category of things that I was characterizing as being quite difficult. But the actual space that you get has this nice description. Okay, so let's remember what the context was in which we encountered that space N3 before. That space N3 came from studying the heterotic string formulated on a 3 torus cross a Minkowski space of dimension 1 plus 6. So some kind of 7-dimensional theory. And it turns out that you can also formulate M theory on a K3 manifold, which is a 4-real dimensional manifold, cross M16. M theory is an 11-dimensional theory, so we require an 11-dimensional spacetime overall. And one of the remarkable duality conjectures, something called string-string duality, asserts that these are the same. Well, there are various versions of it. I've done the 7-dimensional version. There is a 6-dimensional version, which I think is the original one, in which you use the type 2A theory on X4, and it becomes a 4 torus. There's also an 8-dimensional version, which can be seen as a limit of the 7-dimensional version, and I'll be describing that in just a minute. Yeah? This was the original one.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I've actually, that's one of those papers that I've made reference to without ever having looked at, I'm afraid to admit. Yes?
Maybe I'm going to anticipate this, but given the title of your talk, are you going to address or tell us, is there any hope of turning this equivalent, which the string theorists here sort of understand, into a mathematical proof of this hard
I would like to think that one might be able to do something like that at some point. What I don't know is how to encode a lot of details about the Ricci flat metric in the physics. And until I sort of see where a lot of the details about the Ricci flat metric would be hiding in the effective seven-dimensional theory, it's hard to know what they're going to translate into on the heterotic side.
We might imagine making precise statements about some modularized space of spaces from this point of view, but to show that it's Ricci flat.
Why don't we return to it at the end? So this is a statement of general type that I imagine Tom, whose talk I missed, discussed a few weeks ago. And there's a lot of evidence for the existence of this physical duality, and it leads to a number of mathematical surprises. Now, the state of our knowledge of the ingredients that go into the heterotic string is sufficiently primitive still at the moment that I can add some of these surprises in more detail if I go up to what I referred to a moment ago as the eight-dimensional version, which is something called the F-theory limit. And so what I want to do is take a limit on the heterotic side where I let one of the circles have its radius go to infinity, which will leave me with a heterotic model on T2 cross Minkowski space in dimension 8. And it's known how to map the moduli spaces pretty precisely at this point. So it's known what the limit on the M-theory side is. The limit on the M-theory side restricts to a special kind of K3. One in which actually has an equation that I'd like to write for you. So I got at K3s by a certain class of algebraic equations, which were the quartics, but there are other K3s which are described by algebraic equations. And the particular kind that's relevant for this F-theory limit well, again, it's going to be an equation in three variables, x, y, and t. And I'll allow, so-called Laurent monomials, I'll allow some negative exponents in my polynomials just to make a point later on. So the solution set of this, appropriately compactified and interpreted, produces a class of K3 surfaces which have an interesting property. At each value of t, you get a 2 torus with a specified complex structure. This goes back to a piece of mathematics which I hope you did learn when you were an undergraduate, or I hope you were at least exposed to when you were an undergraduate, which is the theory of elliptic integrals. So if I take... No? No? But in physics courses, you learn all sorts of 19th century mathematics when you're an undergraduate, but not elliptic integrals. Yeah, everybody should have learned something about elliptic integrals. Well, it's a beautiful story. I won't spend a lot of time teaching it to you today, but elliptic integrals, as studied by Jacobi in particular, lead to this beautiful story of periods and taking complex numbers, mod, two kinds of translations. Z goes to Z plus N, and Z goes to Z plus 1, and Z goes to Z plus tau. And you sort of identify the set of complex numbers like that, which obviously gives you a two torus, with the solution set to an equation of the form y squared equals x cubed plus ax plus b, which arose from this elliptic the integrand in this elliptic integral in a very obvious way. So here I have some family of two tori with varying complex structure as part of the defining property of the K3, and that special kind of K3 leads to what's known as this F-theory limit. In fact, we're taking degenerate metrics, so we're taking metrics with the area of these two tori having gone to zero. That's the sort of limit that you need to take, which is the corresponding thing to letting the radius on the heterotic side go to infinity. And the remaining data is the complex structure of this specified type on the K3, together with the area of the parameter space of the T2 bundle. Let me just call it that. So that looks like an R plus, and this one looks like a Narayan 2, and we can sort of go one dimension up in this string-string duality type statement. Okay, so still, in order to directly compare to some mathematical statement, I need to take one more limit. And the additional limit that I need to take is the area of the two torus on the heterotic side should be large so that the perturbative description is valid. So when I try to take that other limit, something extremely interesting happens to these K3 surfaces. So here I've got, well, this complicated space, this Narayan space, realized now in terms of these coefficients, ai and bj. Those are labeling things. I get to mod out by some, I can multiply by some non-zero complex scalar in some fancy way without disturbing the structure of this equation. And I also get to mod out by an SL2C, which is acting as fractional linear transformations on the variable t. But anyway, that's some way of presenting this space, this Narayan space, n sub 2. However, seeing what happens as the two torus gets large on the heterotic side so that I can apply these perturbative techniques is a little bit tricky in the geometry. What we need to do is embed this T line into a complex surface. And in fact, what I want to do is think of it as being of the form ST is equal to epsilon on this complex surface with coordinates ST, not epsilon, but lambda, where lambda is some fixed parameter. And I'd like to take my equation over here and think of that equation as coming from some equation in S and T where I use a polynomial of degree 4, homogeneous polynomial of degree 4 in S and T, and a homogeneous polynomial of degree 6 in S and T to describe the equation. So if you take a fixed value of lambda, solve for S, and substitute, you'll discover an equation of the form that I wrote there with the negative exponents allowed, if you've put in this restriction about homogeneous things here. Well, what happens now if I let that parameter lambda go to zero? Well, for lambda non-zero, you get a complex hyperboloid, which is actually connected, it's connected over the complex numbers. For lambda equals zero, I get two lines. And the mathematical surprise, or the surprise, is, and I should say, it's the lambda goes to zero limit in a picture like this, which corresponds to the area of the T2 going to infinity limit. So that's why I'm interested in taking this limit. And the mathematical surprise is that over the origin, over s equal t equals 0, there is an elliptic curve. There is a T2 with a complex structure. A complex structure on a T2 describes a metric on the T2. So the data that I'm describing right now lives on the M theory side, right? This is, this F, just conventionally it's supposed to have been called a G. Sorry about that. The data that I was describing was one of these K3 surfaces described in terms of some equation, and then I've got this rather indirect handle on some metric or some limiting metric where I've let the area go to zero. But it's all supposed to have been captured by the structure of this equation. I took some funny limit of the equation, and in the limit over the limiting equation, there's some certain amount of data that I can extract. One of the pieces of data is the point of intersection. That defines a T2 with a complex structure. And the other thing is the data of the equation over the line. So let me call this star. So if I take star on s equals 0, turns out to exactly be the data needed for an E8 bundle. In other words, a solution of the Yang-Mills equation with structure group E8 on this two torus. And the equation star on t equals 0 is exactly the data for another E8 bundle. So there's this really remarkable way of extracting at least the first part of the mathematics of this string-string duality conjecture. So I felt like I wanted to put in some details, but it still might have been too many. So let me just review it briefly, that I took K3s of a particular form, which were required for the F-theory limit. I wrote a family of those in this form so that I could take this lambda goes to zero limit, and then I discovered that in the limit, the K3 had broken into two pieces, essentially, and each of those pieces had within it the data for some E8 bundle, and the intersection of the pieces had the data of the complex structure that was the remaining thing that you needed for the Narayan moduli space. So this is a really explicit connection between things that really, on the face of them, wouldn't have had any mathematical connection at all. And it's kind of step one in a whole list of interesting mathematical surprises that one learns by trying to study this connection in more detail. So the surprises get sort of more remarkable when you go down in dimension and repeat this story down for, instead of the 6, 7, 8 dimensional theories that I was discussing today, you look at the 4, 5, and 6 dimensional theories where you've taken the complex manifold to be one larger dimensional, but I can't possibly give you the flavor of that, and I'm hoping that this little surprise that I gave here gave you some flavor of the things that we're getting.
I'm not sure why it's a surprise here, are both sides of the framework geometries on K3, or are you really...
No. Remember, on one side I had heterotic on T2.
Okay,
so I had no K3s in the picture whatsoever.
We did.
Good, right. Good. I had heterotic on T2, and I had some kind of E8 cross E8 bundle. And now what I've done is I've taken this M-theory on K3, and I've followed through some limits, and I've manufactured something which, almost by accident, geometrically encodes exactly the data of an E8 bundle on one side, an E8 bundle on the other side, and the metric on the T2. Right? So that's a complete surprise. I mean, that you wouldn't have thought that you would have been able to extract, well.
There's no E8 visible on the K3 side.
There's no E8 visible on the K3 side.
Good.
Yes. To do SO32, well, I set this up very nicely for EACRASIAD, and it's hard to modify it, SO32. But so let me draw a slightly different picture. So I have some family of T2s, which is what I was describing over some kind of base, the base being this hyperbola, and I broke the base in half, giving me two families of T2s over the two halves. And one of those families produced one E8 bundle, one produced the other E8 bundle, and the intersection produced the metric. The SO32 case, instead of the base breaking in half, the fiber breaks in half. So the it's kind of hard to draw, but each of the two tori breaks into a pair of spheres that meet in two points. And what's even harder to draw is the fact that these two points get mixed up by monodromy as you wander around, so you can't tell one from the other globally. But they're meeting, in fact, in a T2, which has a specified metric. And so this set of two points that's wandering around globally with monodromy is actually what's going to define the T2. And the data of the SO32 bundle is also encoded in this picture, but it's not as transparent as in the previous picture. Well, let me make one final comment about this setup, since I spent a lot of time setting it up. And that is that I mentioned that there was some set I had to leave out of the Narayan 3 space when I was describing the set of possible K3 metrics. And that corresponds to certain rather mild singularities appearing on K3 at certain limiting points in this moduli space. And naturally, if there are singularities, you're not going to have a metric in the traditional sense, which is why you don't put those points into the parameter space. Well, there turns out to be a very nice combinatorial description of these singularities in terms of ADE Dinkin diagrams. Literally, there's a process in algebraic geometry known as resolving a singularity, blowing up the singularity, and when you do that, the combinatorics for these class of singularities is exactly encoded by the AD and E Dinkin diagrams. And under this string-string duality, this turns out to exactly correspond to the places where you have enhanced, or the places where you have some unbroken non-abelian gauge symmetry. Generically, the E8 cross E8 has been broken to U1 to the 16 in this story, but there will be places in the moduli space where it isn't broken, and in fact, the singularities that you get exactly tell you what the unbroken gauge symmetry is. Now, there was already some mathematical relationship known between these singularities and groups, but the underlying physics of this, which if Tom gives a second part of his talk, I think he will discuss, is that some particles on this side or new particles are becoming massless at those points, and when you take proper account of those, you learn that you had to have that gauge symmetry enhancement, and it provides a nice explanation of what's going on with this enhanced with this mathematical, already known mathematical coincidence between the Dinkin diagrams showing up both in that classification of singularities and in these groups over here. Okay, maybe I'll stop there.
Is there some sense that geometry becomes less interesting when you go above another dimension?
No.
I mean, are there 400-dimensional manifolds which are new?
Well, let's see. So I can give... It depends what aspect of geometry you're looking at. So, for example, it was an interesting discovery in the early 60s that topology simplifies dramatically starting at 6 dimensions, right? And even 5 is quite a bit simpler. I mean, almost all of the simpler features are already present in 5 dimensions. On the other hand, when you're studying, trying to study detailed versions of things like how do you deform complex structures and complex manifolds, low dimensions you can do it, and high dimensions you don't know how to do it. So
real manifolds are simpler after dimension 6.
Well, topological manifolds, not differentiable. Well, sorry, topological and differentiable are the same. Hang on. No, topological manifolds are simpler starting at dimension 6. Real differentiable manifolds are still sort of complicated.
Until
forever.
Until forever, or you just don't know that
it's not? I'm not an expert. There are these wonderful stories about exotic spheres, exotic differentiable structures on a sphere.
That goes after 7.
Yeah. 7 is where it starts. I don't know.
There's something strange about physics and geometry working so well. But in physics, we see barriers. You're saying the geometry is not.
Right. So another topic I could have tried to talk about today, but again, it would have required even more background to get to, is this topic of mirror symmetry. Now, certain mathematical aspects of mirror symmetry seem to be valid in any dimension. So you can make versions of mirror symmetry for Calabi-Yau manifolds of arbitrary dimension.
Well,
and
it's embedded in artificial.
Pardon?
It's not just a kind of embedded?
No. Yeah. There are new manifolds that come up, and you can make some sense of it. And you can, you can study two-dimensional signal models whose target spaces are these arbitrarily high-dimensional guys and produce some class of conformal field theories that way with central charges of a sort that doesn't relate them to string compactification. So, eleven isn't the barrier there either. The one place it shows up, of course, is the classification of supergravity theories. I mean, which is another mathematical fact, one which was not discovered by mathematicians, but which eventually mathematicians will claim.
You mentioned SO32. Is there something in the way this analysis does that shows you that if you go back to the strong coupling limit, SO32 doesn't become 11 dimensional?
I will answer that by saying that there are a whole interesting list of questions which would be immediately answerable if we knew something about the details of the structure of Ricci flat metrics on K3s. Now, K3s, we've somehow got a better chance of understanding the structure of their metrics than Calabi-Yaus of higher dimension, because there's more, even though there's not symmetry, there's more supersymmetry, and there are just lots of reasons why they're easier to control. I spent a very frustrating year in graduate school attempting to find explicit Ricci flat metrics on K3 surfaces, and have thought about the problem off and on since then, and it's really hard. So that's not a question I've actually thought about, but it seems to me that it would belong on that list. That if I knew enough about Ricci flat metrics, then I might be able to answer it.
No, but you should be able to see from the modulized space that there's no BPS space coming down to zero mass in whatever direction it is you're talking about.
That's true. That's true.
That was the time answer I was thinking.
Okay.
No, but when you have it here and the two walls separated, you don't have the gate distance.
Sure.
Which one?
The ballistic line ground.
But they are not the BPS.
That's just a one E space there. They go from zero.
They go
from
zero.
Thank you.